Welcome to Anxious Like You, a podcast hosted by Micheline Malouf and Nadia Adesi, two therapists who are anxious like you. In each episode, Micheline and Nadia dive into their guests' experience with anxiety and give you the tools you need to face your anxiety head on. This podcast is made in collaboration with Dive Through, a mental wellness company.
On today's episode of Anxious Like You, we're speaking to Lane Moore. Lane Moore is an award-winning comedian, actor, writer, and musician based in New York. She wrote a book called How to Be Alone, If You Want to, and Even If You Don't. And her story has had its obstacles, from being her own parent to living in her car as a teenager, and then moving to New York City to pursue her dreams of becoming a triple threat.
Lane has had a hard time learning how to ask for help, but now she helps others learn how to be alone through her book and delves into different attachment styles, mental health issues, and relationship problems through her TikTok. On this episode, Lane speaks about the difficulty in raising herself from a young age, toxic positivity, trauma, and how her dog has been essential in her healing. So on today's episode, we are here with Lane Moore, and we are just going to dive right in. Lane, we both loved your TED Talk, and we wanted to ask some questions more about it. The first thing we wanted to know is, you mentioned that you raised yourself at a really young age. What age was that, and how did you recognize that that was happening?
I feel like it was really since birth. I don't know that I realized it at birth because I was a baby, but I just remember maybe around, my earliest memories are of me feeling like, oh, this is going to be me against the world, like probably my whole life, or at least most of it. Like, I don't have backup here. So I wrote a book called How to Be Alone. And I really wanted to talk about how that was that I had raised myself, how it was that I had been alone since birth. And, you know, I go into more of it in the book, but it's, I think for so many people who felt really alone as kids and who had to raise themselves at least to some degree, and there's so many more of us than we think there are. I always thought I was the only one. And since releasing this book, I get hundreds of messages every week from people who are like, I had to raise myself too, or like, I had to raise my siblings, or I realized I was totally alone. So I wanted to talk about the nuances of that. I think that so many of the stories that we hear are really these like concrete stories that are like, my parents were drug addicts and that's why. And it's this like really, you know, and that's not easy, but it's this really easy to understand thing that we hear and we go, oh, that was bad, I get it. So I really spent the whole first chapter of the book being like, how do I explain to you when it's more nuanced than that, which oftentimes it is more nuanced. And, you know, it's so much harder, I think, when it's that nuanced, because you're like, well, how do I explain to people that like my parents aren't meth heads, but like it still wasn't great, you know? So, yeah, but I always knew that, and just trying to figure that out.
I think that's like so important to know. And I think a lot of our listeners, you know, listen to that again, because oftentimes emotional neglect is one of the most painful types of trauma. And it's because you feel unseen. So with other traumas, let's say that, you know, you got in a car accident or you were being physically harmed, you know, all of that stuff. Yeah, it's very, very painful. And I'm not comparing here, but I'm saying that at least with that, you know, oh, I'm getting hit and this sucks, or I got in a car accident and this sucks. With emotional neglect, there's a lot of shame, and being abandoned and having to raise yourself, there's a lot of shame and pain that comes along with that. And you start to, and for those of you who don't know that what shame is, it's like feeling that there's something inherently wrong with you, right? And so there's a lot of it's one of the most overlooked traumas, pretty much, and a lot of people end up with symptoms of CPTSD and, you know, just trauma responses all around, attachment issues, not knowing why, because emotional neglect doesn't always show up as, hey, I was left alone in a home with no food. And that's physical abandonment too, but the emotional part is like not having people tell you they love you or really be able to connect with you. So there's so much to that. So I love that you talk about that and, you know, how, you know, that impacted you. Do you find that there's a lot of shame that you feel or felt?
I felt more, that's sticky and complicated. And there's so many emotions I feel about it. I think that it's also tricky, you know, what you just said about like, somebody experiencing emotional neglect, it's also important to talk about when there's multiple things at play. You know, there was so much going on in my childhood that, like, I didn't even realize the neglect portion until years later. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess that would be that. You know, so for people who grew up with so much trauma, they couldn't even process any of it. You know, I think some part of me is, no, I'm not glad. But just that, like, there's some people who they were able to kind of ignore it. And for so many of us, and again, I only know now since writing the book that there are many of us, went through so much, we couldn't block it out because it was so, I always compare it to, like, there's people who in childhood got like a scrape on their arm and it left like a little mark. And so they didn't really have to deal with it. Like, it still affected them and they're gonna have to deal with it eventually. There's a scrape there, it happened. But then there's people who, like, I had all my limbs sawed off. Like, I had no choice but to face this. I'm missing limbs, like, I'm bleeding out. So I think there was just loneliness in that, of being like, wait, is everybody fully missing limbs? Is everybody constantly bleeding out and feeling like nobody else was? Everyone was like, I have all my limbs. I don't know what you're talking about. And you're like, oh, never mind. I didn't even mean it. So forget it. It's fine. And, you know, wanting to, when I wrote How to Be Alone, when I did the TED Talk, it was really an act of bravery. It was terrifying to do because I had never seen anybody write about a story like mine, talk about a story like mine. When people talk about trauma, especially when it's like in a first person autobiographical way, it's always told in this neat compartmentalized, like, when I was 12, I had one horrible day, but it didn't matter because everything else in my life was great. And ever since then, I've been married and I'm fine. And I want, that's not my story. I've never related to those stories. So I wanted to write a book about, like, things were bad. Things were really bad. And I didn't have other people around me. Everything else wasn't fine either. Things are still really hard. Am I the only one? And I genuinely thought when I released the book, I had a genuine fear that people were going to be like, you're so freaking weird. No one else has experienced that. You are the only one. But I did it anyway, because I was like, look, man, if one person is like, oh, that's me, it's worth it. And the beautiful thing that's happened is that now, like I said, I get hundreds of letters that are like, I'd never heard anybody talk about this. I thought it was just me. So I think there is, like, this mutual shame release of just like, well, if it's you, I don't judge you. I don't think you're broken. I think you're great. You don't judge me. You think I'm great? Oh my God, we're both feeling so seen by each other. There's a whole community of us out there that, by, like, raising my hand and being like, by the way, it allowed for all these other people to be like, yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask too, you went from feeling so lonely to putting something out there and realizing, oh my gosh, so many other people are experiencing this. How did that shift feel? Especially because that loneliness lasted for such a long time.
And it's still there. And you know, it's so important for me to talk about how it's still there because, you know, I won't give away the ending of the book, but I remember when I was writing it, like, I felt some sort of internal and maybe external, I don't know, pressure to have the book end with, like, I'm magically not alone anymore. And I got perfectly married. And all my friends are amazing. The book ends in its own beautiful way, but it was so, we're so taught to believe that those are the only narratives that are successful. But what I wanted to do is, I loved the idea of, I mean, it's literally my life, so I didn't have much choice in this, but I loved the idea of a book ending where, like, I've learned to feel connected in the world in my own way. And it hasn't magically, especially as women, we're all taught that, like, we're only really solved once we get married. And I talk a lot about that in the book, and that's so disgusting and inaccurate. And so, you know, I think that the most so many of us can hope for, even if we do get married, even if we, you know, go down that path or able to do that, the fact of the matter is, you're always going to have to learn how to be alone with yourself. You're always going to have to learn that. So, but I'm very careful about, I just don't like how many books end with this, like, and now I'm perfect. Like, in my experience, if you've faced a lot of trauma and adversity in your life, like, you heal and then you heal some more. There's no, you know, I hope to one day get to be that point. Maybe I'll be 90. I don't know. But But I will say at the same time, every single time someone, you know, writes or comments on Instagram or TikTok or all these things, and they're like, this is me, I didn't know this. And it really does work in this beautiful two-pronged way, because I don't, like, even receiving all those letters of people being like, me too, me too, me too, there's still this part of you that for so long you felt like you were the only person. So it was like hard to receive that. And so I was like, yeah, but whatever. It's probably like, it was hard. And so I'm grateful that I have so many people who will reflect to me so often that are like I posted something on Instagram today, and I like to remind people that they're not alone, because I have always felt very alone, always, 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 and still very often feel very alone. And the beautiful thing that happens now is that people will be like, thank you for telling us that, Lane. Also, we would love to remind you, you're not alone. And I'm like, you know me. Like, because yeah. there's still that, like, that's been such a part of my identity of like not feeling seen, not feeling understood, not feeling heard. And I've made so much of my work about helping other people to never feel the way that I felt. And it's really beautiful that people understand that, like, I'm not fully there yet. I still have those wounds. And it is really beautiful that people are like, you do that for us, we want to help do that for you. And it's, you know, it's nice.
Yeah. That's, you know, not being seen. That part is so hard, because as humans, like, we're wired to be connected to other human beings. So being alone is a skill that we have to develop. And I really resonate with that message. And like, I also don't think the happy ending of a story is ever just finding a partner to be with, because and I don't know, like, a lot of the listeners know that, like, Nadia and I talked in my episode of when she interviewed me about I'm married and I'm alone because my husband has like this chronic illness. So I had to learn to be alone even after I was married. So, and it's a hard pill to swallow when you get to points like that in your life, because there's always going to be times when you could be in a crowd full of people and still feel like you're the only one. And when we come at life from that perspective, it can be so painful. Like, it's so painful to feel like you need someone in order to be happy. And that's something that I hear all the time. It's like, well, once I have my partner, once I find someone that loves me, once I find someone that validates me, once, and we're always searching for that next step. And what if that next step never arrives? Or what if it does arrive, but then it's taken away from you, like it was in my story. So it's how did you come to that, you know, point where you obviously, like, as a child having to raise yourself, you probably had a lot of responsibility on your own, you know, maybe take yourself to school. Like, how did you learn that at a young age, and how has it impacted your life now as an adult?
You know, we talk a lot about being self-reliant. And we talk about it like self-reliance is important, but like self-reliance shouldn't be pushing somebody off of a diving board into a pool of hot lava and telling them, like, that's not it. And so, you know, so much of what I like to talk about and I like to explore in my work is the ways that, like, these typical views of the world, the way that we oversimplify things, the way that we ignore so many trauma survivors when we talk about these things is so damaging, because there'll be people who will be like, well, you learned self-reliance. And I'm like, no, I learned abandonment. I learned that I was never going to get any help. I learned that I didn't deserve help. Like, there's all these things that are so painful, and that's not helpful. So, you know, but I try to, as so many trauma survivors do, try to look at the positives and say, like, well, all right, yeah, I'm really good at being self-reliant. Like, all, there's so many things that, like, I've had to learn, and I wish I hadn't had to learn them. Mm-hmm. And I know that we love, you know, we live in a very toxic positivity, oftentimes, culture that wants you to be like, well, at least you got this out of it. And I'm like, I wish I hadn't. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, I wish I'd had an easier time. I wish I'd never had to learn it this way. I wish I'd never had to learn it this intensely. I think that anger, that refusal of the is so important to me. And, like, one of the things that I talk about in How to Be Alone that is so important to me and feels like I should bring it up here is that how often you can trauma survivors can feel unseen when they quote unquote turned out great. Mm-hmm. And that's so, it was so important for me to talk about that because I know that there was actually, have you watched Firefly Lane?
No, I don't think that.
So. Okay, it's totally fine. It's like a new show on Netflix, but there was this beautiful line in it where she was like talking to her mom who was really not great. She's talking to her as an adult. And you know, this character in the show is now this like Oprah-esque figure. And you know, she's helping other people, all these things. And her mom was like, well, I don't worry about you. You know, you turned out so great. And it's, the line is so simple, but it hit me so hard. And she was like, I'm not great, I'm broken. And I was like, oh. Like, and it's not that you want to view yourself as broken. I mean, it's okay if you do, but it just hit me so hard because so often we see people, we see that they have these flourishing careers. We see that maybe they got married or maybe they're helping other people and they turned out okay, quote unquote. And it's like, oh God, no, I'm still working through so much of this. And you know, it can feel so hard to feel seen. And honestly, that was a big reason that I wrote the book and did the TED Talk because so many people knew me from like, oh, I liked your stuff in The Onion or I read your stuff in Cosmo, you're funny. And I was like, it's important for me to tell both parts of this story that like, yes, I'm a comedian and all of these things and you know that, but like, I need you to know there's more than this. And I'm not somebody who's had a really easy time. That's not my story. So, yeah.
I think something so powerful that you said was, I wish I didn't have to learn that. And I think that's something that's not talked about enough. For me personally, like the first couple of times I was seeing a therapist, it was that made you stronger, like good for you. Look at what you learned, exactly what you said, at least. And it wasn't until I met a therapist that was like, no, that sucked. You did not deserve that. There does not need to be another side to it that look at the bright side or look what it taught you. And that's when I was like, okay, you're my therapist, because that's exactly what sometimes like people need to hear. That like that toxic positivity makes you feel like you almost deserved your trauma or it made you a stronger person. It made you a better person when just like end of sentence, it sucked.
Yeah.
Did not deserve it. Did not want it. And I think that's a message we need to continue to spread because with everything on social media, it almost makes you feel like I said, you kind of deserved your trauma or you should be grateful for it because look where it brought you today.
Or
somehow it had to happen. Level.
Ugh.
Yeah.
It's like somehow it had to happen to you so that you could become the person you are today. And that is so fucked up.
It's so fucked up. Also because I'm like, you know what? Like, and I had a guy I dated years ago, like he said some dumb trash like that was like, well, I love the person you became. And I'm like, you know what, Brad or whatever, it probably, you know, could have been. I remember myself as a child. I was bright and I was strong and I had strong convictions and I believed in right and wrong and I wanted to help people and I was funny and I was brave. And I could have just been like that. Like, I reject the idea that this made me who I was. No, I've had to become who I am despite this. And I had to actually retreat to who I originally was because it actually got me farther away from it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what happens. It's like people see what they want to see and they are going to use that toxic positivity. Brené Brown, I think, said it best. I love her so much. She said something like, people use toxic positivity because they're saying that their comfort is more important than your feelings.
Absolutely.
And that's been, I would say, like when you talk about like not feeling seen, that's been most of my life experience is that I knew that like I had to make other people comfortable and no one wanted to know or see, because I believe a lot of people know when stuff is going on and they don't want to see it. And that's its own harsh reality.
And the large, like a very large number of trauma survivors are people pleasers for that. Like we're afraid, we're walking on eggshells. We just want people to accept us and love us. And you mentioned it in your TED talk, you were like, it's almost like I romanticized being dependent, like wanting that dependence on somebody. You mentioned that, right? Like, it's almost like, I don't know what it's like to have that dependence on somebody, like somebody it's full that I can depend on to do things.
Yeah, I remember what it was now. What did I say specifically? But yeah, because we talk about feeling that safe and loved with another person, like it's innate. like, oh, everybody has somebody that they just feel so seen by and so safe with, and they can just tell anything to. And I'm like, that sounds like freaking heaven. Where is that? And we don't all get it, but we talk about it like, oh, everybody has that person. And I'm like, that sounds surreal to me. Like, it sounds next level. And that says so much, that it's so outside the box. And then, you know, feeling so unseen by having somebody else tell you that, like, oh, it's a box of cookies. Everybody has it in their kitchen. You don't have that box. And I'm like, well, where do I get that? And they're like, you just get it. And I'm like, can you point me to a store? And they're like, no. And like, you feel weirder and weirder.
Yeah. Yeah. You develop that, like, there's something wrong with me because I don't have it. And obviously everybody else does. How do they get it? Is it me? Am I not good enough? Do I not deserve this? Did I do something bad to make
it? What sign up deadline did I miss? I was not told. I would have missed. I'm very much into calendars. I would have set a date.
Yeah. It's like, it feeds that notion that, like, I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not likable. I'm not lovable. Like, all of the core beliefs that we're probably developing anyway, because of our childhood trauma. So that's what trauma does to you. It doesn't make you stronger. You're strong. You have resilience. You're a human being. You have a personality. You know, you are who you are, and you don't need to go through anything in your life in order for you to be who you are. That shouldn't be a prerequisite. We shouldn't be making that, like, statement, because it can be really, really hurtful, especially coming from someone who has no idea what trauma is or hasn't.
No idea. Yeah. Anybody who says that is either, like, wildly not in touch with their own trauma or has never experienced it. And that's a whole other thing, because it's like, there's so many people who, again, either are divorced from it and don't want to face it, or have never experienced trauma. And those will be the people who will tell you how to be. And you're like, oh God, like, I don't want to have this discussion with you, because you're going to see it from, like, this place of privilege. And I'm going to see it from this place of, like, I know how this really feels. And that's really challenging.
How did you cope? Like, what got you through?
My coping has always been creative. I'm very grateful that since I was born, like, I knew what my purpose was in life. I knew it. And so I leaned into that very hardcore. Like, I remember from my youngest age always being like, I want to be, like, writer, actor, musician, and, you know, comedian, all these things. And so I spent so much of my childhood just, like, trying to sing, like, every single singer I loved, trying to hit every single note of every musician I loved, you know, studying comedy, reading, writing. I just was, like, putting in my 10,000 hours and more, because I knew, because A, I loved it and I felt like myself, but I was also like, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm supposed to do here. And, you know, so I love, and those were, so in my, like, How to Be Alone book dedication, it's a list of the movies and music and books and TV shows that I loved as a kid, because they were the reason I wasn't alone. Like, all of those things were my family, they're my friends, and they're what got me through them. You know, I would put on a TV show, and I still do this now, and it's like, you're hanging out with your friends, and, like, you belong somewhere, and you know these people, and it's like, so I really love now that I'm an adult and I get to do these things for a living, that people will be like, oh, I'm going through a really hard time, so I, you know, I've been rereading your book, or I've been, like, listening to your songs, or, like, your jokes of, you know, I'm pouring over this thing. And it's like, that's exactly what I wanted, though. It's like, when I grow up, I'm going to make, you know, TV and movies and music and books to fill the same space that all these other people have done for me. It was huge. Yeah.
Wow.
So you found family and comfort in, like, movies and music.
And all these performers, and it's beautiful, but, like, so many of them I've become friends with now, and, like, they've read the book now. Like, my friend is, Fiona Apple was huge for me growing up, and, like, still is, but my friend is friends with her, and she was like, I gave her a copy of your book. And I was like, my book is sitting in Fiona Apple's house. Like, all these, like, full circle, beautiful things of, like, that person, you know, just that feeling of, like, this is the only person who understands me. You know, you see whoever you have in art, if you're wired like this, which I very much am, obviously. And you're like, you're the only one I feel seen by, you're the only one I get. And, you know, to now it's like this beautiful two-pronged thing where it's like when we were able to tour and I was on tour and things like that, and people would come up and they would like, you know, like in their book signed or whatever, and they would cry and they'd be like, I'm sorry, this is so stupid. And I was like, I always, when I have the spoons to tell them, like, I always like being like, do you know like how cool it is? Like how many people I've cried on because they were the only one I felt seen by? Do you know what an honor it is to be on the receiving end of that and know that I've been your Fiona Apple? Like, it's just, mm-hmm. it's beautiful. And it's everything, you know, as hard as life can be many times, I'm like, well, I still have that. And that's really yeah. huge.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the cliche therapist question of like, how does it feel that you went from using those people and those movies and shows to find comfort for now people using, not using you, but finding that in you as well?
Like the- it's weird, but great, because that's always what I wanted to do. And I just, it's really surreal, but I feel very, you know, and I have a lot of self-doubt still that I wish I didn't have. So it's like, you know, I'm sure one day I won't need to hear that. One day I'll just know it, or it won't matter, and I'll be so whole that no one's reaction to anything will bother me. It sounds amazing. But you know, it really has become this source of like community, because I'm also able to like, on my good days, I'm able to express kind of the deeper meaning behind that of like someone saying like they feel so seen by this. I'm like, all right, well, to at least a small degree, this person's also seeing me. Because I think that's something I really struggle with, honestly, is that like all the things I do, all the things I talk about in order to help other people feel seen, I don't really have very many people who make me feel seen. I still don't really have that. And so I understand why this resonates so much to people, because I don't really know, like there's not that many people who do that for me even. So I struggle with that sometimes, but I try to find some sort of solace in the fact that there are people who, because I've made this thing, are like, and I guess now that I think about it, it has formed like real life friendships that are really beautiful, that like people read the book. And I talked to a friend of mine last night, and she was like, we met because of the book. She hosted a book reading event for me and we became friends. And she was like, I read this book. And I was like, I know this person. I know this person. I understand this person. And I want to be friends with this person. And that I think that was the coolest thing, really, was that like, I was being completely like cards on the table. Things have been really hard. Here's the way that I think about things. There was something really special about, again, terrifying, still kind of terrifying, but about, you know, usually in friendships and things like that, you have to wait like 6 months, you know, for you to be like, and then I kind of went through this and then like, here's all my thing. But in doing this with the book, it was like, you can just slide it over and you're like, here's the stuff. And then to have somebody read it and they're like, I see all of this and I love you immediately. And you're like, mm-hmm. that's amazing. Yeah.
You don't need to hide yourself. You're being seen and loved for who you are, being vulnerable. And that's like the opposite of feeling that shame, because you're showing up as exactly that person that you're like, you know, this is it. If you still accept me after this, like you're my people.
Totally. And that's my least favorite part of friendship, really, is all of the like, how many emotions can I trust you with? And then finding out that they're not good at emotions or whatever it is. And it's interesting because now that I think about it, a lot of, you know, at least a few of my very close friends happened because they'd read the book and been like, I love this person. And I was like, oh, I think you're great too. You like fully love me. And they're like, yeah. And because I didn't have to go through that, you know, and then, you know, I know that's not accessible to everybody. Like just write a book about all of these things. And then, you know, but for me, it's a nicer shortcut than the very painful process that I've been through many times of getting really close to somebody and then they can't show up for you.
That is so, okay. So this is a really good point, because I was listening to, I don't know if it was an audiobook or a podcast, but they said that one of the things that keeps you stuck oftentimes are secrets. And the reason that secrets keep you stuck is because when you have secrets and you're meeting people with these secrets and you're not showing them who you are, then they're getting to know you for this other person you're showing them, right? You're so scared to show them who you are. Maybe they don't have the equipment to handle you as you truly are, yourself. And so we invest all of this time and energy into these people. And 6 months down the line, we decide, okay, maybe I trust them to open up to them. And then they're like, oh shit, no, that's not what I was expecting. And then now you're abandoned. Whereas in your case, or like in a book, or if we just show up as who we are, it's like, hey, this is, here it is, lay it out on the table. And they don't accept you. You haven't invested much time. It hurts, but at least you can move on and find the people that are going to accept you. Just save so much time. And it's freeing to you because you're showing up as who you are.
Yeah. And it's like, so there's like, there's that part, but then there's like a part on that I want to add, because what's happened to me is like, so sometimes it's that, and I do love leading like fully with who you are. And I think that that has been very freeing with me, but there's also the element of sometimes I've had friendships with people where like, I kept being vulnerable with them and they kept having shitty reactions, and I kept sublimating my own needs and being like, it's fine, just keep the friendship, it's fine. And it's like, no, that was not fine. And so that, like, it's what you're saying, but it's also having like the courage and the self-awareness to be like, I showed them who I really was. All of me is lovable and beautiful. They can't show up for me, I'm out. And with me, it's like, I tend to stay in things way too long and be like, oh, well, and then, you know, 2 years later, I'm like, this person is trash for you. Like, maybe they're not a trash person, but they're trash for you, is like, that's something I'm going through.
Boundaries.
Right now.
Boundaries, yeah. What you're saying. It's like, you're not showing up for, I think people think, oh, I just have to set boundaries with people who are jerks to me. But sometimes it's not just people who are jerks to you. It's people who just aren't a good fit. Like, you wouldn't date everybody and marry everybody, right? Like, you wouldn't want, you also don't have to be friends or expect the friends that you meet to be the one friend or like the one.
We do that though. We do that. It's like, we just get so invested and it's like, but I'm already friends with her. Like, and then we're stuck in this horrible toxic relationship where, like, oftentimes in my case, the person was getting everything they needed. They felt so great. And I felt drained and used and neglected and not seen. But I was so, you know, that people pleaser part of like, but they're so happy. I'm making them so happy. This relationship is great. And I was like, Lane, I think you hate them though. Like, just, this isn't, it has to be that. It's so challenging.
That's all too relatable. I even find like, okay, I'm going to make them love me and then I'll tell them everything else. And by that time, it's going to be too late because they already love me and they can't leave. But then
it's like, sometimes they don't leave and they stay and they're still not good for you. So,
and they suck.
Right. Yeah. Like, and it's this process of like, I did the first part of that, which was like, I'm going to be a friend and blah, blah, blah. Oh my God, they're not leaving. And I'm like, they're not leaving, but they're not being good either. Sometimes people stay and like, yeah, I haven't been abandoned, but also I'm being neglected or I'm being abandoned in other ways. Like, who cares if they're still here?
Yes.
They're like not really here though.
Physical presence is not the same as connection.
No.
And again, you can be alone and with a person at the same time. And I would argue that it's the worst kind of feeling alone.
Oh, way worse. And that's like, and then you have to be like, how do I get out of this? This is so bad, because we don't, you know, we don't talk about that ever. We're just like, you're friends for life, or like, how could you, you know? And that's,
yeah,
so much of what I talk about and how to be alone, and was really important for me to talk about, is like the toxic way that our culture looks at extracting yourself from toxic friends, family members, anything like this. There's so much shame of like, you just play the hand that you're dealt. They're in your life. They're in your life forever. They can do whatever they want to you. And it was so important to me in the book to like talk about how hard that had been for me to learn, like, actually, no. And even now, you know, like, I've written this book, I've done the TED Talk, I talk about it so much online, But I still have to remind myself, like, oh my God, I get to leave. If this feels bad, I get to leave. Because I don't want to leave. I don't want to leave anybody. And it's like, but, you know, and it's putting too much of the blame on yourself when you didn't do anything wrong. It's very hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We talk about boundaries all the time in therapy. And that's like by far one of the hardest things that I think everyone has trouble with, because we're taught as a society that we put others before ourselves. That's just always been the case. That's always
good
been
to hear if you're a narcissist or you're self-serving, like then you need to hear that. But for the rest of us, we don't need to hear that anymore.
No,
I don't need to be reminded of that. I lean way too much on the other pendulum.
Yeah. Like, we always hear family's family, but that's your mom, but that's your dad. How can you just leave? Mm-hmm. Same with friends. You've been childhood friends. You're just not going to be their friend anymore.
And this is what's so important to me to talk about, because once I realized that, I was like, oh, why don't we ever talk about it as like, that's your kid. Why aren't you going to treat them better? That's your friend. Why aren't you going to treat them better? Like, we never talk about it that way. It's always like, that's a person in your life. Why won't you continue to be abused by them? It's never like, how dare you hurt that person?
Right.
Never. And that's right. So disgusting.
So I actually posted a semi-controversial video on TikTok the other day, because it shouldn't have been controversial. It was really, I said something. Yeah. I said something like, you know, people who go to therapy, and it's been a thing that people have said before. So it wasn't like I made it up. It was just like something that I was reinforcing. And it was like, you know, people don't go to therapy because you're the problem. You go to therapy because people around you who are the problem didn't go to therapy. And what I meant by that isn't that you don't have your own personal struggles and issues. Obviously we all do, and we can all benefit from therapy. I'm a therapist. I'm never dissing therapy, but people took that as, well, no, like, you know, we're the problem. We have to. And the thing is, it's like, yeah, we developed the problem, but we developed the problem because society has a problem. And because, you know, our families have a problem, and because, you know, generations have had a problem, and it's just like passed down year after year, after generation, and, you know, society doesn't change. And of course we're going to end up like, I think every single year, the numbers go up of people who are struggling with mental illness. And, you know, we still talk toxic positivity. We still tell people, you know, to walk it off and just, you know, go out and just smile and just say positive affirmations in the mirror and just, you know, oh, it made you stronger. And I think that's the part that's fucked up. Like, why don't we acknowledge that there's a problem in our society and in our families? I think it's so shameful for people to say, yeah, you know, my mom or my dad or my cousin or my uncle or whatever fucked up. Like, we can love them and still think they fucked up. Like, it doesn't have to be like this one exclusive side of the spectrum, which I think where people get stuck. Yeah. It's not. Most of the time it's not. It's like, they could be great people.
And I literally, like, I had therapy right before this, because I know how to plan a day. But that's literally what we were talking about, where I was like, you know, some part of me truly loves so many people who were very harmful to me. And it's like, both can be true. And that is brutal. But again, you can't divorce one from the other. Like, it can be, you know, someone you love can have been abusive, and some part of you can still love them and they are still abusive. Like, yes. I think we need to hold these mm-hmm. these dualities and these forms of nuance and exactly understanding that, like, you know, since pop culture is such a big deal for me, one of the things that, and I don't remember if I talk about this in the TED Talk as well, but I definitely do in the book, is like all the messages that we get about from media and TV and all these things about what family is, what family means, and what romantic partnerships mean, how they'll look, how you'll get them, and how damaging that is. That, like, we're all trying to live up to, like, everyone has this but you.
Yeah. Awful. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I heard you mention earlier spoons. Mm-hmm. Said if I have enough spoons for this, and yeah. I love spoons theory, and I love, like, that whole concept. Okay. And I want to know, would you share with us and our listeners, you know, what spoons are and, like, how you utilize them to keep yourself healthy?
Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't realize anything about, you know, that I was someone with chronic illness. I had just gotten used to sucking it up. because I was deeply traumatized and, you know, and I've had it my whole life. And you know, just once I realized, and, you know, I'm still not where I want to be with it, but once I just realized, like, oh, I don't have, the idea behind spoons is that, you know, you have a certain amount of energy a day. So it's like, you know, 10 spoons or whatever it is. And like, you, it might not be enough for your day. And like one activity, you know, making one phone call might be particularly stressful. I'm like, that's all of your spoons. And now you're done. And you don't have the energy, the physical, mental, emotional, spiritual energy for the rest of your day. And throughout this pandemic and just a lot of crisis, like pretty much every day I wake up with like negative 8 spoons and I still have to like cobble together a life. Like it's brutal. And I don't, you know, it's one of those things where it's like people who get it, extremely get it. People who, it's okay. So controversial post time. I posted like one of my tweets on Instagram, and it was, I posted a tweet that was like one of my life goals is to be able to be at a party or be out somewhere and without any explanation, just be like, yeah, I'm out, and just leave. And just no further explanation, no explaining, just leave. Everybody got it, except there was like one commenter who was like, I think that's really selfish. That shouldn't be normalized. That's not okay. And I was like, because they were like, what about your friends who need you? Like, that's not acceptable. And I was like, that's not really what I meant. And any friend of mine would want me to feel whole and safe. Like, obviously I'm not talking about abandoning people. I'm coming from a place of people pleasing, a place of having chronic illness, a place of not putting my needs first, and way too often giving everybody everything and me nothing. Maybe they didn't know that. And they replied and they were like, well, I had a friend who claimed it was that, and it really wasn't, and they weren't showing up for me. And I was like, okay, that's totally valid. That's not what I mean. And I think it, you know, it's one of those ways that language fails us, and people can use language in a negative way. People can co-opt, you know, language of just like, oh, I left, I just wasn't feeling it. And they are assholes, they are crappy, and they are, you know, not showing up for you maybe. However, we can't take that small portion of society that has co-opted this very real experience of being extremely drained and needing to be like, I'm out, I don't have the energy to explain it to you, just know that I love you, I'll see you later. I don't, like, that's just a very, again, it's that nuanced conversation of like, I know there are people who use trauma-informed language to be dicks, mm-hmm. but we can't punish people who are using it to accurately depict their very real experiences and punish them for that. That doesn't, exactly. No.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, going back to the spoons for a minute, what might, like with the spoons, like you said, like you might get 10 a day or whatever. And people would think, okay, 10 a day, let's say somebody who doesn't have chronic illness and doesn't have mental health challenges or trauma or whatever, yeah. could use, okay, I need a spoon to get out of bed, a spoon to brush my teeth, a spoon to put my clothes on. Whereas a person with chronic illness or pain may need 3 spoons to get out of bed, right. and then may need 5 spoons
or to get a glass of water or to take yes. their meds. Like, you just don't know.
And whatever spoons are like you overuse because you have to go to work and you can't skip, like, let's say you've used up your 10 spoons before you even get in the car to go to work. And now you've gone to work and work takes 10 spoons. So now the next day you're waking up with negative 10 spoons, like you said. Yep. And so that's why I think with people who struggle with mental illness, there's this like stigma that, okay, they're flaky. They never make plans. They're quiet. They're, you know, all of these things that people say about them. And that's why I think we make a lot of posts about like things you don't realize are hard for people with anxiety or hard for people with trauma or hard for people with depression. It's because like, usually they want to be able to do those things. Like, you want to be able to hang out and go out and like be a friend and be at the party and not just like have to walk out when yeah, a friend awesome. Is in need. But there are times when we have to make a choice. Like, do we use up more spoons than we're already in negative? Do we go home and like, we're passed out for like 2 days and we can't get out of bed because we chose to, you know, be some place where we shouldn't. We have to put ourselves first in these cases. We have to honor our bodies. We have to listen to ourselves. That is a form of self-care. That is a form of repairing.
And it's like, it's so hard as somebody who struggles so much with people pleasing and all of these things. It's like, I know how much pain that I carry around it, that eventually I just like stopped talking to that comment. Cause I was like, I know who I am. And I know that this struggle is so real for me and you're not hearing me and that's okay. Like you're bringing your own thing to the table and I hear you and I validate you. But like to tell me that me trying to carve out a space where I am not letting myself bleed out so that somebody else can have a good day is selfish. I'm not here for that. That's not what I'm talking about. That's not the conversation I'm having with myself or with others. And I don't want people to get that twisted. Yeah.
I think we also need to normalize the question of, do you have the emotional, mental, physical capacity to deal with this right now or to join me here today or to talk to me about this? If not, fine.
Right. Because, you know, and I know like, you know, there was that like tweet that blew up a while ago and it was like the way she said it, people took her to task for that. And it's like, okay, sure. I get that. There's a way you can do it in a compassionate way, but again, you know, it's so tough. And it's like, you really have to, this is what I'm working on and learning and probably will largely be what the next book is about. But like, it's like you, because of that though, you have to surround yourself with people who get it.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge in and of itself. Cause you're like, damn it. Like now I have to surround myself with like trauma informed, like empathetic, like that just creates these other barriers. And again, you know, the potential rewards are beautiful, but that is exhausting too, where you're just like, oh, it's not you either. All right. Well, it's been a good 2 years. And then you move along your way and you got to find someone who gets that. And I will say that like, I've started to find those people and it's next level, because it's hard when you're already struggling with trauma or chronic illness or, you know, neurodivergence or all of these things, to have to explain to somebody how to care for you. And then the shame and guilt you feel with that too is like exhausting. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And if you're not trauma informed and you're listening to this and you want to be that person for someone and show up for someone, just educate yourself. There's a way to do it. And there's a way to make a change and find a way to be there for someone, your friend, your family member who needs that support. It's not impossible. It doesn't take a super long amount of time if you're willing to put in the time and effort, but you can do it.
It's literally like anything else. It's like being anti-racist. It's you know, being anti-sexist. It's all of these things where it's like, listen, that person can educate you a certain amount, but like the internet
to work.
The internet exists. We've been talking about it. Like, just listen. And there's so much you can, you know, I think we need to take so much of the burden off of survivors to like translate for people. We're very tired, you know.
yeah and it's hard because like when you're talking from it's almost like you have to open up certain wounds because when people don't understand it, when they're not trauma informed and they don't understand why a certain event may have caused you so much pain, it's hard to talk to somebody who doesn't get it, because it's like furthering this, like, again, we'll go back to shame for a minute, because trauma and shame are like really closely tied together. And so you have this, like, you're talking to someone about something that you felt was like, well, why am I still feeling this? Cause that's most trauma survivors I know will say, should I be over this by now? Like, we think that.
And that's rightful. Yeah. It's like any other, it's like any chronic illness where you're like, I still have to deal with this. I want a refund. Like, this is not cool.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's so hard when somebody doesn't get it, because then, you know, you're there and they're saying, they're kind of minimizing it or invalidating it or asking questions in a way that is like, well, shouldn't you, or don't you? Well, you have a house to live in. You wrote a book, you have been on, you know, on TV, you have things going for you. And we go back to like, look how you turned out. Shouldn't you be over it by now? And that will go in and you're like, well, no, but wait, should I? And so you start to question your own
self. And I've, you know, and there's some of those, because with the internet and everybody, it's like, there will be some of those people, you know, it's like, there'll always be some of those people who are like that. And, you know, I'm fortunately bolstered by my own work on myself and my own work to make myself feel seen by me. And that's a big part of how to be alone and how to be okay with yourself is like, I've had to be my own best friend my whole life. I've had to be my own everything. And again, I don't love that, but it's valuable. It is really valuable. And it's something that like, even people who haven't experienced, like what's interesting to me is like, I get a lot of feedback from people who are like, you know, I didn't have a ton of trauma. I actually had a really great childhood. I've had a really, you know, pretty like easy life by my standards, whatever, who's saying this. And I still fully understand your book and your perspective. And I still feel alone all the time. So what's interesting is, you know, you can think that it's so specific to you, but then some of it is really just being a human. And that's been really interesting for me to learn. I thought it was like, oh, it's because I survived this and I survived this and now I'm weird and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, actually, like, it might have been magnified by the things that I went through, but a lot of it are just very human experiences. And that's been really interesting for me to realize.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you found a family that you call your family that's not blood family, or Ooh. Is that difficult?
I want that so badly. The closest that I have so far is, so in the book I talk about, I got a rescue dog. And I talk a lot about that in the book because it was a really pivotal thing for me. My dog was the first time that I experienced this, like really just beautiful love and care. And like, she's genuinely magic. And it was so, she's absolutely my family. And I wanted to talk about how magical and helpful and healing animals can be for trauma survivors, people with chronic illness. I feel so like understood and protected. And like, I swear I'll be like, you know, filming TikToks or whatever it is. And I'll look over and my dog has like a very prominent constant smile. And I swear to God, she looks at me and she's just smiling like, you're doing great. I'm so proud of you. I love you so much. And I'm like, I know. Like there's just, dude, even when I filmed my TED talk, she came with me to Colorado, or was it Colorado? Yeah. She came with me to Colorado. And there's a photo that someone took of her watching me give my TED talk. And she's watching me like she's my little child watching her mom give a TED talk. And she's like sitting up like, that's my mom. And the person who held her while I was there was like a stranger who worked with TED. And he was like, when you got up on stage, she wanted to run and be with you. And I was like, my baby. So I'm like, she's very much like, and it's been very like, I talk a lot in the book about how like taking care of her and realizing that she also takes care of me, like that kind of reciprocity was new for me and is new for a lot of people. And yeah, I can't, I've heard from so many people who read the book and now have rescue animals. And I'm like, yay, because I really wish I'd done it so much sooner, because it is, she's the largest sense of family that I have. Like I've been able to explore a lot of my fear around connections with her, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pets are extremely valuable for trauma survivors, especially because a lot of trauma survivors, especially childhood trauma, is attachment trauma. And a lot of it is danger cues when we meet people and humans and we can't form connections. But again, we need connections in order to survive, and we need connections in order to thrive, not just survive. And dogs and cats can, and animals, horses. I mean, there's so many different types of animals that I've heard have served as support for humans that can actually make you feel safer than a human can.
10 out of 10. I like, and I tell her I love her like 17,000 times a day. Like just genuinely will be like, like yeah. She's more important to me than anybody, which is terrifying because she's a dog. And you know, she knows she's not allowed to ever die. Like she has to live forever, but you know, but it's scary. It's scary. You know, I know exactly. I try not to, but it's, again, it's that attachment.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm anxious attachment. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're an anxiously attached person.
Oh yeah, I'm very proud of this. I'm actually anxious secure now. So like, I'm a good person. I know I've been through. I talk a lot about attachment theory in the book because it was so huge for me to recognize my own attachment theory, my own attachment style, and my partners and friends and all of these things that I was like, I have to share this because it's, and I've gone through. It's funny because like I'll do these video. I do a lot of videos, like comedy videos about attachment on like TikTok and Instagram and things like that. And every now and again, I'll get a comment that's like, are you a therapist? Like, how did you learn about this? And I'm like, well, I've had every attachment style and I've dated every attachment style and I had to heal it all on my own. So it's like, I know it from a very deep level where it's like, oh, I've been avoidant. I've been anxious avoidant. I've been anxious. Now I'm anxious secure. Like, I know all of them. I know how they all interact. Like, it's all lived plus research. And so, yeah, it's been very, very pivotal for me. And sometimes even just realizing like, oh, we're just never going to connect because of this.
Yeah. Is real. I think we definitely have to have a whole episode on attachment styles because it gets so like, yeah, it's a very important topic, especially for trauma survivors. I think for everybody,
I think the lived experience is almost more valuable than just the research, especially if you've been through them all. That's huge.
I think so too. And of course, you know, it's like, it's great to have that other component, but
yeah.
I love when people are like, it's interesting. Like, you're not a therapist, but I feel so seen by this. And I'm like, it's because I've literally lived it. Like, it's not, it's completely different. And so, you know, and it's funny too, because again, part of the like, how to be alone thing, like I had to be my own therapist for a long time. I had to, and I'm somebody who is very researched and invested and really wanted to heal. And so I had a therapist years ago that was like, you know, you're basically a therapist, right? And I was like, thank you so much for honoring that. That is very true. So I know I don't get paid in that way and I don't have titles after my name, but you know, I think like a lot of us, it's like, if you really went through some shit and you didn't have access, like, you might like I've heard other trauma survivors say this, that like when they've met the wrong therapist, they felt like they knew more. And that is such a bizarre, like I felt that so many times. So it does feel kind of nice for people who are like, oh my God, you're like kind of like a therapist to me. And I'm like, thank you. This goes out to all the therapists who like didn't understand me at all. And I had to know more than them. Again, it's that I wish I wasn't. I wish I didn't have to learn to be a therapist. I don't really love that I've had to take on this whole extra workload. However, since this is my circumstance, it's cool that it's helping people. It's cool that I'm able to engage with my community in this way, in a different way that's also valuable. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you said, there's value.
Yeah. So valuable. Yeah. I mean, and we've talked about this before where it's like therapists have to do their own, like in graduate school, they don't teach you attachment theory. They don't teach you polyvagal theory. They don't teach you how to treat clients. You're a therapist that, if you're a good therapist, you're a therapist that's going out and getting trained in these things and reading books and learning about them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there's bad apples and there's people that just stop at the degree. And yes, there's credits that they have to do every year or whatever, but you can do their minimum with that. And so if you know more than your therapist, anyone listening, if you know more than your therapist,
get out, run. Because it happened to me so many times. And it's like, because again, that's not what you want. Like anytime, I mean, this happened to me the other day, and I actually love my therapist now, but I was like telling her about something and she was like, I've never heard that phrase before. What is that? And like, there was a part, I got very triggered by that, because there was a part of me that was like, oh no, am I in another one where I'm like educating my own therapist again? But it was just that she hadn't heard the term. She fully understood it. But but I love when my therapist says something that I'm like, oh, that's a way I hadn't thought to look at it. Because people who know so much and they're bringing so much to their own healing, it's so important to have somebody who's able to help you look at it in another way, especially if you have trauma brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why therapists befriend therapists, because it's like we know so much stuff. We like have so much insight that like people who don't have therapy insight, it's like, how do I go to them for my problem? Because they're going to say these things. But like what I really need is someone to like go into this like area.
I've ended up being friends with a lot of, it's interesting, not so much therapists. I don't know a lot of I don't know a lot of therapists, but I am friends with a lot of healers, whether that's, you know, they're hypnotists or they're like hypnotherapists or yoga teachers or Reiki masters. I'm friends with a lot of those people because they're similarly very sensitive and they're, so it's really just befriending other healers to me, which is just bringing that to a broader thing, but because that's absolutely what it is. And it's like, you know, I have feelings about the word healer because I'm not coming at it from some sort of like, yeah, I'm a healer. I'm like helping it. Like, I don't come at it from that like ego place, but it's like, that's really, but it's also, that is what it is like, you are trying to help people heal and help yourself heal. So the purest form of the word healer, I very much identify with, but I feel the need to say all those things because healer can sound very like, I'm a healer. Obviously I'm perfect. And I'm saying like, it can sound very
woo-woo. I get that. Well, I think that you have an incredible story and I'm glad that you wrote a book about it because I, like you said at the beginning, we've talked about it throughout the whole episode is that, you know, people are going to feel less alone when hearing your story, when reading your book, when, and even it kind of reciprocates back to you because they reach out to you and remind you that you're not alone, that you've, you know, you've got people that care and love you. So I thank you so much for being open and vulnerable and talking to us. I know it wasn't easy. But I think we've had some really awesome conversations around a lot of really important topics.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm glad I could be here.
Well, thank you so much. And, where can people find you, follow you and your book so that people can go out and buy it?
Yeah. So I'm on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok, all the things at Hello Lane Moore. And the book is How to Be Alone If You Want To, and Even If You Don't, and you can get it at your local bookstore. You can get it at, you know, Amazon, wherever you buy books. It's also on audiobook and I read the audiobook and, I sing on the audiobook cause there's like a song that I wrote about an attachment style thing. And I sing on that and that's fun.
I'm going to have to listen to the audiobook.
Yeah. It's really fun. I've had a lot of people who are like, it was like hanging out with you for like 8 hours. And I was like, that's cool. Also very cute fact. My rescue dog sat on my lap the entirety of recording the audiobook and just like, it was so beautiful. Very cute.
Yeah. Love it.
You can know that when you're listening to it, that there was a very cute dog in my lap.
Well, now people know.
Yes.
Well, thank you again so much for being on here. I've truly enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, make sure to subscribe and leave a review. Join the Anxious Like You community by following at Anxious Like You on Instagram. See you in the next episode.